She nodded. I remember. You told me about it. The guy reached for his camera and you shot him, right?
He reached for his bag and I shot him. Later, we figured out he reached for the camera. He had no weapon in the bag.
Zoe seemed to mull that over. Feeling a bit chilly, Tatum swam to the other side of the pool, then back. Why did they reopen the case? She asked.
There's supposedly a new witness.
Could the witness have seen anything that would reflect badly on you?
No,
Tatum said flatly.
They'd have seen what happened. I had no way of knowing that he wasn't going for a gun.
Did you say anything before you shot him?
Just told the man to put his hands up.
Did you call him by his name?
What?
Did you call the man by his name? Or simply tell him to put his hands up?
What difference does it make?
It's perceived differently. Which was it? Tatum pulled himself out of the pool, the water trickling on the white stone. He grabbed his towel from the nearby plastic chair and dried himself while verifying his short stunt still worked. He tugged at them a bit, then sat by Zoe, towel over his shoulders.
I think I called him by his last name. It was Wells, so I said something like, Wells, put your hands up.
Just his last name? Did you say anything else? Were you speaking clearly?
It's no big deal, Zoe. Someone's just kicking up some dirt. Don't worry about it.
If they reopen the case, they have a reason. It is a big deal.
No pressure or anything,
Tatum said irritably. He wished he hadn't brought the subject up. You were chasing him, right?
Yeah. He grabbed a young girl on the street while we were watching.
How long did you chase him?
I don't know, a couple of blocks. The guy wasn't exactly an athlete.
Zoe's phone blipped. She snatched it from the ground, the screen lighting her face. Her shoulders sagged and her lips twisted in a small smile.
Andrea?
Yes. She's fine. Your grandfather came by to see her today.
Yeah?
Tatum raised an eyebrow.
And she survived it.
She said he was a nice old man.
Then I don't think it's the same guy. It's probably someone else's grandfather.
Zoe laughed. It was a surprising burst of happiness. And Tatum was aware it wasn't due to his razor-sharp wit. It was a laughter born of pure relief. He smiled at her warmly.
Do you want to grab something to eat?
He asked.
I'm starving.
And he was. His stomach gave a sudden rumble, cheering at the mention of food. Sure. Zoe stood up, water drops trickling down her legs. She picked up her sandals from the ground. Aren't you worried at all? About the internal affairs investigation?
Nah, it'll blow over. It's just a bit of static.
He stood up as well, turning toward the staircase. Did you really think it was a gun? The question made him pause in utter surprise. He glanced back at Zoe. Her face was calm, but her eyes bored into his unblinking.
Of course, he answered. I shot him.
And he was a pedophile. You were working on the case for a long time. A difficult case. A sexual predator who targets children.
Yes,
the word dragged in his mouth. Tatum tensed, feeling the anger bubbling below the surface. He tried to contain it. She was just asking a simple question.
And I really wanted to catch the guy. I wanted him arrested.
Pedophiles are frequently repeat offenders. If he went to prison, he'd be out in a few years, free to molest kids again. You knew that. And then you conned him. And he wanted to destroy the evidence he had with him.
I didn't see.
Even in that moment, after chasing him, adrenaline pumping in your veins, you called him by his name. He wasn't just a threat. It was a very specific threat.
Zoe, drop it.
You have conviction, Zoe said. You want to make a difference. It's possible that when you had to make a snap judgment call, you made a rash action. Maybe you even convinced yourself that—
Are you profiling me?
Tatum asked in disbelief. Up until that moment, he thought she was talking about the way the case was perceived. But no, she was actually analyzing him. It's totally understandable. If you believed he had to be stopped—
He was going for a gun.
It was a camera.
I thought it was a gun.
Only as he heard his words echoing back to him from the motel buildings around him did Tatum realize he had shouted. Zoe gaped at him in surprise.
Why are you angry? I didn't say—
Tatum raised his hand to quiet her, trembling with fury.
Never profile me. You got that? I'm not one of your subjects.
I just want you to be ready. If they ask you difficult questions—
There are no difficult questions, Bentley, because I defended myself against a man who I thought was armed. I would never shoot an unarmed man, and you should know that.
I'm not saying you did anything wrong. I'm just saying they could point out that you reacted more aggressively than you should have.
This isn't about them at all. This is what you think.
I wasn't there.
Exactly. You weren't. And you could try and take my word for what happened there.
He brushed past her, gritting his teeth. His appetite had left him, and despite his recent swim, his body pulsed with heat. Chapter 19. San Angelo, Texas. Friday, May 9th, 1986. The boy hid in his room. Not the best hiding spot, but when you were scared, you went to your safe place. This was his tortoise shell, his bunker, his haven, where he could curl, clutching his E.T. doll, guarded by Superman, who stood sentry from a poster above the boy's bed. Did they know? His dad's binoculars had always mesmerized him. A simple object, though surprisingly heavy. And when he held them to his eyes, wonders happened. The boy could read the license plate of a car driving down the road, could see the faces of the people entering the hairdresser's salon at the end of the street. With his dad's binoculars, he developed a superpower, superhuman eyesight. There was a rule, of course. Always with Daddy, never alone. But what sort of superhero went with his daddy everywhere? And besides, Daddy never let him look at the neighbor. And that was his favorite pastime with his superhuman eyesight. Mrs. Palmer lived just across the street, and he could glimpse fragments of her bedroom with the binoculars, a fact that excited him whether she was there or not. He broke the rule. And the more he did, the more he needed to do it again. Always careful, never when his parents were around. Weekends were the best, because they slept late, and so did Mrs. Palmer. He could watch her, uninterrupted. But that morning when she'd woken up, about to get dressed, she'd suddenly turned to the window, frowning. For a second she'd just stood there, looking straight at him. He couldn't have moved even if he'd wanted to. And then she lunged for the drape on the window, pulled it shut, and he knew he'd been caught. He had bolted to his room, a panicky, uncontrollable response. He was muttering silent prayers, promising God that if Mrs. Palmer didn't call his parents, he would never watch her again. He'd never touch the binoculars again. The binoculars. They were still in his hands. He needed to put them back in place before— The phone rang. A shrill, loud noise from the living room. He could bolt there, answer before his parents. Tell them it was a wrong number. Maybe he could convince Mrs. Palmer that he was looking at birds. Instead, he curled tighter into the corner. His bed stood adjacent to his green desk, and if he sat just right, his feet held close to his chest, he was hidden from the door. If his parents came into the room, they wouldn't be able to see him. Another superpower he had. Invisibility. His mother answered the phone. He could hear her sleepy voice as she answered, her tone becoming sharp and alert as the conversation went on. He had to come up with a plan. But his mother's steps and angry voice clarified it was too late. She called his name, her voice shrill, furious. The sound of a storm approaching. Tears of fear clogged his throat. Door flung open. For a second, his mother just stood in the doorway, muttering to herself.
Where is he?
Invisibility. Best superpower ever. But then she stepped inside the room and the spell was broken. Her face was ruddy and furious. She screamed his name again, shrieking about the neighbor, about the binoculars. He went for the only course of action left. Denial. What neighbor? He was watching the birds.
And now you're lying to me!
His mom yelled in disbelief. She grabbed his arm, began dragging him across the room out of the door. For a moment he tried to struggle, dragged his feet, but superhuman strength was not one of his superpowers. He wailed and begged and said he was sorry. That should be the magic word, right? Sorry? He was sorry. He was so, so sorry. She took him downstairs to the basement. He needed to be punished. He needed time to think about what he had done wrong. As if he hadn't just spent the past 20 minutes thinking non-stop about it. Other parents, he knew, hit their children when they misbehaved. Robbie from his class once told him his dad spanked him on his bottom 100 times. But his parents didn't hit their children. Hitting children was wrong. His parents believed a punishment had to be educational. His mom always said he needed time to think about his actions. A broom closet lurked in the basement, a dark place within a dark place. Please, Mommy. He was sorry. He was so sorry. He would never do it again. He'd learned his lesson. He would apologize to Mrs. Palmer. He was sorry. She pushed him into the broom closet and slammed the door, latching it. He heard her footsteps as she strode away, climbing the stairs, closing the basement door behind her. The tight space above him smelled of cleaning supplies, dust, mold, and nightmares. He sobbed and thumped the door and screeched that he was sorry. It was dark in the broom closet. So dark it was almost like going blind. This wasn't the first time he'd been there. He often needed time to think. It always smelled the same. He could always feel the terror clogging his throat as the darkness closed in on him. Why did Mrs. Palmer have to call his mom? He wasn't hurting anyone. She could have just closed the blinds. Or if she wanted him to stop, she could have talked to him. He would have listened. It was her fault he was here. She did this to him. In the darkness, all he could do was listen, hearing his mother's footsteps somewhere above him, hearing the phone ring. Somewhere far away, a radio, a snatch of static and music. A third superpower, superhearing, and he needed all the superpowers he could get. Because in the darkness, the monsters came.
Chapter 20. San Angelo, Texas. Wednesday, September 7th, 2016. Zoe was exhausted. After Tatum's sudden outburst the night before, she'd eaten alone and then tried to go to bed. But sleep had refused to come. She'd mulled over the conversation, trying to figure out what had triggered Tatum. She'd finally decided he was dumb, that all male federal agents were dumb, and in fact, men in general were dumb. When she'd managed to fall asleep, she'd had a nightmare about Andrea, and had woken up before sunrise. Luckily, they had a Starbucks just across the road from their motel, and by the time Tatum came to tell her tersely he was leaving for the police station if she wanted a ride, she had drunk a Grande Americano. The ride to the police station was short and tense. Tatum remained stony and impassive for the entire drive. Zoe tried several times to talk about their strategy when working with the San Angelo police, but his responses were so snappish and unpleasant that she finally stopped trying and resolved to get Uber rides for the remainder of the visit. If Chief Mancuso complained about the additional expense, Zoe would tell her she was welcome to ride with Tatum herself. Lieutenant Jensen intercepted them both as they entered the division. He seemed to be dressed in a brand new suit, his hair carefully combed, his shoes shiny.
Agents, good to see you here. We were just about to start the task force meeting.
What task force? Tatum growled.
The chief of police instructed us to form a task force to investigate the Medina murder case,
Jensen explained.
We were hoping you'd be able to join and provide your opinion on how to proceed.
Right,
Tatum said dryly.
Provide our opinion. Through here, agents.
Jensen walked down the hall.
I'm not an agent, Zoe followed him. I'm an FBI consultant.
Oh,
Jensen said in disinterest. He strode at a brisk pace, but his short legs made it easy for her to walk beside him. Tatum stomped behind them, a dark maelstrom of discontent.
I'm a civilian consul.
In here.
Jensen marched through a door into a large room. Most of the space was taken by a large, off-white rectangular table and two rows of chairs. There was a large whiteboard on which someone had written, Nicole Medina, September 2nd. Three people sat by the table.
Detective Foster sat on the right side next to a red-headed woman, her hair swept back into a ponytail. On the other side sat a bald man, his bushy eyebrows intersecting into one perfect unibrow. The brow seemed like a bird in flight, and the man raised it a fraction when Zoe looked at him, making the bird flap its hairy wings. It was very distracting. Jensen closed the door and clapped his hands together.
Right, he announced. Now that we're all here, we can start. First, let's introduce everyone. You've already met Detective Foster? That's Detective Carol Lyons.
The woman nodded at Zoe and Tatum.
And you probably know Agent Shelton?
Jensen gestured at the man with the bird-like eyebrows, apparently assuming all federal agents knew each other.
No, we never met,
the man said.
Brian Shelton from the San Antonio field office. Oh?
Jensen said. Zoe suspected it was his response whenever things went off script.
Well then, these are Agents Gray and Bentley. I mean, Agent Gray and,
He seemed suddenly at a loss of words. Dr. Bentley, Zoe said frostily.
Now we all know each other.
Jensen clapped his hands again. Zoe sat down by Agent Shelton. Tatum sat down next to Detective Lyons. Zoe met Tatum's gaze and he glanced away, clenching his jaw.
Let's go over the details of the case,
Jensen said.
Detective Foster.
Foster cleared his throat and launched into a summary of the case, ending with the discovery of Nicole Medina's body the day before. Consulting the pages in front of him, he began to detail the initial findings.
The cause of death is assumed by the medical examiner to be environmental asphyxiation,
Foster said.
He estimates the time of death to be between 2 and 8 a.m. on September 3rd, though we'll know more once he concludes his autopsy. The victim was buried inside a wooden handmade box. A small infrared camera and a microphone were mounted inside the box to capture the video. They were connected to a cable that ran out of the grave. The cable's other edge was clipped and covered with earth, presumably to hide it once the murderer finished recording the video. We found a lot of fingerprints inside the box, and we're comparing them to the victim's fingerprints. No fingerprints on the camera, the exterior of the box, or the cable. We also collected some DNA samples from the interior of the coffin, mostly hair, a broken fingernail, some blood.
He glanced at Agent Shelton.
Our lab will be processing those samples shortly, comparing them to the victim's DNA and checking them against CODIS,
Shelton said.
We have some tire marks from the scene, but...
His eyes darted toward Zoe for a short second.
They were mostly covered and erased during our attempt to rescue the victim.
Zoe's face remained blank, and she didn't bother to point out she had told them as much the day before. She never understood people's urge to say, I told you so. It was like taking pride in the fact that you weren't convincing enough.
The crime scene technicians are doing a second sweep this morning, collecting shoe impressions from the ground. However, the topmost soil is thin dust, and it was very windy 2 days ago. Add to that the people who were digging up the grave, and I'm not optimistic.
Jensen cleared his throat.
Our top priority had been to save Medina's life, if it was possible, of course.
It was an obvious attempt to avoid accusations of professional inadequacy. Zoe tried to catch Tatum's eyes, knowing that on any other day he'd roll them comically. But he focused on Foster, ignoring Zoe.
The autopsy is scheduled to start in the afternoon,
Foster said.
Our crime scene technicians are currently working on the box, trying to get as much information about it as possible.
He glanced at his papers.
The mobile phone the killer used is offline, so we can't track it. It seems it was turned on for the first time near the gravesite, so we can't use it at the moment to analyze his movements before the burial either.
He tapped his pages on the table, aligning them into an orderly stack.
That's what we have so far. Good. Please send your summary by email to all the participants of this meeting,
Jensen said.
Yep, will do. I guess the most important question on the agenda is obvious. Is this a serial killer?
Jensen glanced at Tatum, and then at Zoe expectantly.
A serial killer is defined as a murderer who kills at least two people on separate occasions,
Tatum answered.
So far, we have no evidence that's the case. Doesn't it take at least three victims to define a serial killer?
Jensen asked. No, Zoe answered, a fraction of a second before Tatum and Agent Shelton said the same. Zoe leaned forward. We changed it back in 2005. The definition is an offender who kills two or more victims in separate events.
The video that he published is titled Experiment Number One,
Jensen pointed out.
Should we expect another victim in the future?
We have absolutely no way of knowing that yet, Zoe said. We need to investigate further. There's a clear possibility it really is a serial killer.
There's a press conference in,
he checked his wristwatch.
32 minutes. What do we tell them?
Nothing. You cancel the conference.
That's impossible. They already know a body has been found. Someone will connect it to the video. We need to stay in control of the situation.
I agree completely. Zoe clenched a fist under the table. She now understood why Jensen was dressed so nicely. Which is why you must avoid involving the press for as long as you can. At least until we know more.
As I said, that's impossible.
Jensen turned to Tatum, like a patient looking for a second opinion.
Our aim is to reduce rumors and panic. If this is a serial killer,
Tatum said gravely.
He might react to the press interest in him. It might prod him to kill again. I agree with Dr. Bentley. No.
Zoe suspected the press conference would happen no matter what. Give them the barest details with no room for interpretation. If you want to reduce panic, you should refrain from using the term serial killer.
Right.
Jensen clapped his hands again.
That's settled. Now for our next steps. I think we have some promising leads. The Mexican Mafia, for one. We should talk to Medina's father.
If I may, Lieutenant,
Detective Lyons interjected.
I have an additional inquiry line in mind.
Oh?
Jensen blinked at her in surprise.
We are currently working under the assumption that Medina was kidnapped right after being dropped off by her friends, before she entered the house. We should make sure this assumption holds. Interview all her friends again. Get our timeline as detailed as possible. Also, if she really was taken, then the killer either waited for her by her home, or he followed them from the party. We should check the red light camera footage for any vehicles that went by in close proximity to the friend's car.
Foster kept his gaze on Lyons, his mouth twitching in a slight smile. They were playing the lieutenant. Zoe was sure of it. Lyons did the talking because they knew, for whatever reason, that Jensen would be more susceptible to it.
Also, once we have the tech results, Lyons continued, it's likely we'll have a lead on the box's maker. If the killer didn't make it himself, we could follow that lead. And of course, we'll try to monitor the killer's phone number.
Jensen blinked and cleared his throat.
Of course. That sounds like a reasonable course of action. We're trying to determine the digital traces that the killer left,
Agent Shelton said.
We'll let you know if anything pops up. And there's the issue of the upload origin. Yes.
Jensen's face was blank.
Upload origin. The video was uploaded on site.
Shelton scrunched his forehead, and the eyebrow bird folded its wings as if about to dive.
The murderer must have used a cellular modem. He could have used his phone as a hotspot,
Foster pointed out.
We already checked all the phone's activity,
Shelton said.
The CNN footage is the only thing it was used for. We'll pull all the data we have on the nearby cell towers. Since the crime scene is in a remote area, that won't be a very long list. If he uploaded from the site, we'll find the record for it, and then we might be able to use it to track the killer.
Jensen kept nodding throughout that explanation. Satisfied, he glanced at Tatum.
Agent, anything you want to add? Dr. Bentley and I will start working on an initial profile,
Tatum said.
We would appreciate full access to all the evidence collected from the crime scene, including the photographs. Of course.
Jensen made an elaborate gesture. It would have looked reasonable on a king granting his subjects wishes, but was utterly absurd in this context.
Let's get to work.
Chapter 21. Tatum was almost by the door when Zoe grabbed his arm. Can you hang on for just a second? She asked. He went rigid at her touch.
Sure.
They stood by the doorway as the rest of the meeting's participants walked out the door. Agent Shelton was the last to leave, and he gave them a querying look. Tatum nodded at him and gave him a small, polite smile. The agent shrugged and left as well.
We need to decide how to approach this case, Zoe said. There's a lot of work to do. Tatum had guessed she wasn't about to talk about what she'd said the night before, let alone apologize. Still, he felt a pang of anger and disappointment. He needed to vent. If she'd told him to stop acting like a child, at least he'd have a good opportunity to snap back. He'd spent half the night before thinking of all the things he should have said when Zoe had casually called him a murderer. But saying them now would be pointless. Comebacks had a very limited expiration date.
Of course, he said. We need to look at past crime reports in the area. Assuming the killer's fantasy has a claustrophobic angle, we can check anything that involves shutting people in small cramped spaces.
Maybe see if any prostitutes reported anything like that. A customer who made them lie in a closed box for a long time or a car's trunk.
Okay. I'll look at past cases in the area.
I'll try VICAP. Zoe sighed. Tatum understood her tone. VICAP should have been perfect for this kind of investigation. The FBI's Violent Criminal Apprehension Program was supposed to be a database of all violent crimes across the country. If the killer had committed violent crimes in other states before, it should have been reported and logged. Theoretically, all Zoe would need to do was to search for other incidents of people being buried alive, and voila, she'd get a list of similar cases. Except there were a few snags. The major one was that less than 1% of all violent crimes were logged in the VICAP database. The second problem was, of course, that there was no checkbox in the VICAP entry form for buried alive. However, Tatum's sympathy ran low at the moment, and he didn't offer to help out with the workload.
The nickname of the uploader is Schrodinger, and it's probably not a coincidence.
We should both study Schrodinger as well, Zoe said. If he's really referencing Schrodinger's cat, we should understand the experiment better.
It's pretty straightforward. You put a cat in a box, you close the box, and for some reason the cat might die at some point. So the cat is alive, but also dead.
Why is he alive and also dead? He's either alive or dead.
I mean, because we don't really know. It's a physics thing, I guess.
A second of silence.
We should both study Schrodinger, Zoe said again.
Chapter 22 Zoe sat alone in the meeting room, her laptop in front of her, papers and printed photographs scattered all over the table. She'd asked Jensen earlier if she could use the room to work, and after a lot of hemming and hawing, he'd agreed. Tatum was in the detective division, sitting in the cubicle belonging to the man who was on vacation. This worked out nicely as far as Zoe was concerned. With Tatum's present state of mind, she found him quite unbearable. The laptop was open on the VICAP search screen. She'd run 8 different searches that morning and ended up with over 200 cases that could be connected to the Medina case. Sifting through them was both difficult and unproductive. She had questions she needed answered. How had the victim been taken? What did the toxicology report say? Where was the box from? Questions that would be answered in due time. But Zoe was used to being consulted when a case stalled and all the immediate questions had been answered already. One of the things she'd heard a lot in the BAU was, if only they'd called us sooner. As if the profilers could show up after one act of violence, point out the guilty party like some sort of real-life Poirot, and prevent all the other crimes that followed. And now here she was, pretty much as soon as she could possibly be, and it turned out she was as clueless as the rest of them. She massaged her forehead, knowing she wasn't in her element. She was distracted by Tatum's anger and by her distance from Andrea. At the thought of her sister, she instantly imagined Andrea carelessly going to the parking lot, not noticing the dark figure waiting by her car, holding a gray tie in his clenched fists. She clenched her jaw and grabbed her phone. She tapped a quick message to Andrea. Hey, how are you this morning? To her surprise, the chat window indicated that Andrea opened it almost instantly, a significant change for the better.
Fine. How's the case?
Zoe sighed and answered.
A bit messy, and Tatum's angry at me.
What did you do?
Nothing, he's just being a baby.
Andrea sent an emoji with its eyebrow raised, and Zoe found its suspicious expression quite annoying.
I need to go back to work, she tapped.
Talk later?
Sure.
Feeling relieved, Zoe stood up and paced the room.
It was time to change tack, to start again. She couldn't figure out anything conclusive yet, but she could theorize. Nicole, in all likelihood, had been killed by a stranger. If she'd been killed by someone who knew her for one of the common motives, say greed or jealousy, the killer wouldn't go to all that length of burying her alive, filming it, posting it online. No. The drive that had propelled the killer here was different. A couple of markers lay by the whiteboard. Taking one, she began to make a list. Buried alive. Remote location. Online video. After circling the words buried alive, she drew a line from it, ending with the word claustrophobia. Then, hesitating, she checked online for the term for the fear of being buried alive and wrote it down. Taphophobia. She'd already seen indications that the killer had been sexually stimulated. Now she sat down in front of the laptop, clicked the video file, and followed the killer's actions. Twice during the video, the killer stopped filling the grave and disappeared from the frame. In the second instance, it took him 3 minutes to return. By the third time she watched the video, she was positive. When he left, his posture was rigid and hurried. When he returned, he was relaxed and calm. He'd stepped out of the frame to masturbate. Her confidence bolstered, she connected two more words to the diagram. Dominance and control. These two drives were common with sexual serial killers, and certainly applied here. She moved on to remote location. She drew new lines from it and wrote down planning and van. Time for the third bullet. Online video. This was what concerned her the most, and it was the main reason she wanted the police to keep a lid on the press as long as possible. She could think of only one reason for him to post the video, and she wrote it down, underlining it 3 times. Fame. Some serial killers weren't just driven by fantasies. They were driven by the desire for fame. The Son of Sam and BTK were classic examples, sending letters to the press, boasting of their actions. And now, with the internet's wide grasp, the killer didn't even need to reach out to the press. But in this age of endless distractions and TLDRs, he couldn't just post long rambling letters like the Son of Sam had. No one would read them. He had to move on with the times. He'd posted a video. This could have serious consequences for his killing rate. When a serial killer acted on his fantasies, there would often be long stretches of time between the killings. The memory of the murder and its reenactment in their mind was good enough to curb the compulsion to kill, at least for a while. But if a killer murdered for attention, he might kill again whenever he felt he was losing the focus of the crowd. And these days, when news went stale fast, it meant he'd start getting that frustrating sensation very soon. The meeting room door opened, startling her out of her focus. Foster and Lyons stepped into the room.
Bentley, there you are, Foster said. The autopsy is...
The words faded as he inspected the whiteboard.
Is this the profile?
Zoe shook her head.
No, just ideas. I won't have anything concrete until tomorrow.
What's taphophobia?
He asked.
The fear of being buried alive, Zoe answered.
Specific. Lyons quirked her eyebrow.
You think the killer is taphophobic?
Foster asked.
I don't know, but he's sexually aroused by the act of burying a woman alive. It's common for fear and sexual stimulation to be connected. I'm almost certain he masturbated at a certain point in the video. Off camera, of course.
Really? Lyons twisted her mouth in disgust.
You should canvas the crime scene with a UV camera. Search for spots of semen. We might get lucky.
Lucky,
Foster remarked dryly. He exchanged looks with Lyons. Zoe ignored their reaction. She had no patience for coddling them.
This is a sexual killing, through and through.
She frowned at the whiteboard, focusing on the word planning.
Except something here doesn't fit.
What? Lyons asked.
Serial killers usually harbor their sexual fantasies in a sort of gestation phase until something stressful happens. We call it the stressor. It could be a relationship ending, a getting fired, something that weighs heavily on them. The stress gets too much and they snap and kill, fulfilling their original fantasy. Once they cross that barrier, making that first killing, the next one comes easier. They plan it more thoroughly, think of all the things they could do to improve their technique. But that first murder is almost always an impulsive act.
No planning.
Foster glanced at the whiteboard. Exactly. This murder was elaborately planned. He had to build her out of the box, find a location, get the website ready. He was very careful with his burner phone, and cleaned up after himself as well. These are not impulsive actions. I believe it took him a month or two to do some research and plan them out. Maybe this killer is different, Lyon suggested. He could be, Zoe shrugged. But there's a simpler explanation. Something stressed him. He snapped and killed, probably on the same week. And then, after a while, he planned his next murders.
Then, are you saying?
There's at least one more victim we haven't found yet, Zoe said. But he called this experiment number one, Lyons pointed out weakly. I wouldn't subscribe too much to that. There could be endless reasons why he did that. I think there's a good chance he buried another girl sometime in the past. Not too long ago. A few months. Lyons seemed pale. Excuse me, she said faintly and left. Zoe considered asking Foster what was wrong with Lyons, then decided it was none of her business. If the woman got a fainting fit whenever murder was involved, perhaps she was in the wrong line of work.
I actually came here to tell you the autopsy is done, Foster said. We were about to talk to the medical examiner. Do you want to tag along?
I'll come in a moment. Zoe regarded the whiteboard. She wanted to think this through while the ideas were fresh in her mind. Chapter 23 Tatum followed Detective Foster into the autopsy room. It was the first time since they'd landed in Texas he'd felt chilly. He wore a thin white buttoned shirt and immediately regretted the absence of his jacket. But then, as the smell hit, his discomfort with the temperature took a back seat. The scents of formalin, disinfectant, raw flesh and blood all mixed together into an unbearable stench that had him breathing shallowly through his mouth. He never got used to this smell. A box of face masks stood on a shiny steel cabinet by the door, and Foster snagged two, handing one to Tatum. Nicole Medina's body lay naked on a steel bed in the middle of the room, a Y-shaped scar of an autopsy operation covering her torso. The body's skin was gray in the room's cold light, but even in its current state, Tatum could easily see the girl from the video. The medical examiner was hunched over a microscope. He was dressed in white coveralls, stained brown in several places, and his mouth and nose were covered by a mask as well. His head was bald, and the white fluorescent light made his scalp seem even paler than it was. As they stepped closer, he straightened, peering at them through a pair of thick glasses.
It's freezing here, Curly.
Foster rubbed his hands together.
How can you work like this? I wear warm socks,
the man said. His eyes crinkled, and Tatum guessed he was smiling under the mask. The door to the autopsy room opened, and Zoe strode briskly inside. She paused two steps in, presumably as the smell hit her, her face gaining a slightly sickly look. Tatum wondered if Zoe's nose, which was a bit longer than most, made her more vulnerable to the surrounding aroma. Before he could remember that he was furious at her, he gestured at the box by the door.
There are face masks over there.
She turned back and quickly retrieved a face mask. Foster motioned at Tatum.
Curly, this is Agent Gray and Dr. Bentley. They're consulting on the Medina case. And this,
he pointed at the medical examiner,
is our medical examiner, Curly.
The medical examiner rolled his eyes and turned to Tatum.
Curly is my school nickname. I'm Dr. Clyde Prescott. Nice to meet you.
Foster turned to Zoe.
Curly was just about to walk us through the autopsy report.
Curly picked up a clipboard from the counter and scanned it.
Nicole Medina, aged 19, The cause of death is almost certainly asphyxia due to environmental suffocation. Almost certainly?
Foster asked.
There is no evidence of any serious trauma to the body, and considering the location where the body was found, environmental suffocation is the reasonable conclusion. However, to be sure, you'll need to wait for the toxicology report.
He pointed at the body's hip, which had a greenish-black hue. Tatum looked away after a quick glance at it.
The early putrefaction started on the iliac fossa. This, combined with the potassium concentration in the vitreous humor, led me to deduce that the victim died approximately 80 hours before discovery. How approximate?
Foster asked.
The victim was young and healthy, and the body was kept in a relatively clean environment, protected from insects and heat. So it's accurate, within 4 hours.
This was actually a much better approximation than Tatum had assumed they would get. He made a quick calculation.
Between 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. on September 3rd. That's right. Lividity marks over the back of the body indicate the deceased died lying on her back, and that the body wasn't moved after death.
He walked around the autopsy table, looking down at Medina's body.
Multiple scratches and bruises on her knees, palms, elbows, and feet all seemed to be consistent with repeatedly hitting and kicking a hard wooden lid. There were 3 old fractures, probably from early childhood. 2 on the left leg, 1 across her right wrist. All 3 fractures healed well. The stomach was empty, which is not surprising, since it's likely she didn't have access to food in the last 12 hours of her life.
Any signs of a sexual encounter? Either fast or consensual, Zoe said.
I swabbed the mouth, vaginal, and anal cavities, and checked for foreign elements, but there were none. There is a large stain on the victim's trousers, but it's urine, not sperm.
He pointed at the body's neck, and Tatum craned forward. A thin, long scratch marred the skin.
This scratch is fairly new,
Curly said.
Examined closely, it looks like a sharp and smooth object cut the skin. It didn't cut deep.
Someone cut her with a blade?
Tatum asked.
Yes, but I don't think the intention was to kill her. My guess is someone held a blade to her throat and it cut her. See the angle? This probably indicates whoever did it stood behind her. If you look at her left arm, you'll see a bruise there. That's where it grabbed her.
Tatum pictured it in his mind. Nicole getting out of the car in her home's driveway. The street is dark. She starts walking toward the entrance when someone grabs her left arm fiercely and holds a knife to her throat.
The man who did this is right-handed.
Foster echoed at Tatum's own conclusion. This wasn't a big surprise. The man on the video was right-handed as well.
Any signs of struggle? Nothing visible. I clipped her fingernails and sent them for testing.
No sign she was tied either.
No.
Tatum considered this.
Make sure the toxicology test includes date rape drugs. It could explain why the victim didn't struggle, even when he put her in a box.
Date rape drugs weren't always in the standard toxicology test to save costs. It was best to make sure. Curly made a note.
I'll make sure they test for it. Ketamine and flunitrazepam would definitely show traces in the hair samples.
Tatum couldn't wait to leave the autopsy room, but he forced himself to take one last look at the victim. Nicole Medina had probably lost consciousness before she died, and her eyes were shut, face serene. But there was no question regarding the terror she'd felt shut in the dark, cramped space. It must have seemed to her that no one could hear her as she screamed. Ironically, her screams had been heard by many people, but no one could help her in time. Chapter 24. I wasn't sure how you drink your coffee. Zoe raised her eyes from her laptop, looking at the speaker. It was Detective Lyons. She held 2 cups of coffee in one hand, balancing a pink pastry box in the other, looking as if it required no effort. Zoe knew if she tried this acrobatic feat, she'd end up with a large coffee stain on her crotch and a bunch of pastries on the floor. Lyons stepped into the room, putting the cups and the box on the table. She then took 1 cup and drank from it. I didn't add sugar. That's fine, thanks. Zoe took the other cup. She sipped from it and kept her face carefully blank. The coffee was so weak that it was nearly like drinking tepid water. Lyons opened the box. It had four donuts in it, two chocolate frosted and two vanilla frosted with sprinkles. She took one of the chocolate ones and motioned for Zoe to dig in. Thanks, Zoe said again, taking a vanilla donut. A young woman disappeared in San Angelo 6 weeks ago, Lyons said. Her name is Maribel Howe, age 22. How did you? Zoe turned her laptop around so Lyons could see the screen. It displayed the NAMU's missing persons database. I looked through some databases, searching for missing persons in Texas, Zoe explained. Of all the people who were reported missing in San Angelo in the past 6 months, Maribel Howe is the only one still missing.
I'm investigating the Howe case, Lyons said, though I hit a dead end early on. She went out to see a film with some friends on Saturday evening.
You don't want the other chocolate donut?
I'm good. I'm addicted to chocolate donuts. I really should stop. But when the craving hits me, my stomach takes the steering wheel. Cops and their donuts, right?
Right. Zoe didn't recall ever working with a cop who regularly ate donuts, but someone probably had to perpetuate the myth.
Anyway, Lyons continued, taking the second donut. She disappeared in a similar fashion. She'd gone to see a movie with a friend. They shared an Uber ride on the way home. They live on the same street, just a few houses apart. The driver dropped them by the friend's house, about 30 yards from Howe's home. Howe said goodbye to her friend and walked to her own house. In the morning, she didn't show up for work. Her boss called her several times, got worried, sent one of her co-workers to check up on her. There was nobody in her home, and after a few hours of repeatedly phoning her, they called the police.
You think she was taken like Nicole Medina, near a home?
Lyons shrugged.
Maribel Howe wasn't Nicole Medina. She was 22, lived alone. Her friend told us she hated the city, hated her job, always talked about leaving. She didn't get along with her parents. She left home when she was 18. And she disappeared soon after two of the detectives from the division had retired, so we were seriously understaffed. I'm not saying I stopped searching, but I had half a dozen cases to juggle. And when push came to shove, it was easy to assume she just decided to skip town.
Lyons put her half-eaten chocolate donut back in the box. I checked her Instagram page occasionally, she said after a few seconds, her voice thick. She used to update it all the time, like a few photos every day. But after she went missing, there was nothing. She took out her phone, tapped it a few times, and handed it to Zoe. It was Maribel's Instagram account, and the last image was from July 29th. Maribel and another girl, smiling at the camera, their heads tilted slightly toward each other. The caption read, Alexander Skarsgård, here we come. Zoe glanced at Lyons.
Who's Alexander?
Hot movie actor. Maribel was beautiful. She was one of those girls who knew how to put on makeup, so it looked effortless and perfect. Her lips glistening red, long, thick eyelashes that seemed almost natural, her black hair cut short and pixie-like. She wore a strapless green top and had a mischievous smile, as if hinting that when Alexander finally met her, he'd forget about Hollywood and move to San Angelo.
Her mother still calls me every week, Lyons said. She wants an update, and I have nothing. But you know what I think now?
Zoe didn't answer. Lyons' eyes were misty.
I think she's buried somewhere around here.
Chapter 25 Delia Howe was doing the dishes, scrubbing furiously. Every day the same thing. Frank with his damn bacon and eggs. She kept telling him to rinse the dish once he was done. It's not rocket science. You put the dish half a second under the faucet and that's it. But she was lucky if he even bothered to put the plate in the sink once he was done. And by the time she got to it, the egg leftovers hardened, becoming a discolored yellow stain, and she had to scrub it endlessly to get it off the plate. Tomorrow, she'd let Frank eat off a dirty dish. Maybe he'd finally get the damn message. He probably wouldn't even notice. She shook her head, her lips pressed to a fine line. Frank was hardly even talking to her since Maribel had disappeared. He acted as if it was all her fault. Her fault Maribel had left home,
Her fault Maribel didn't watch out for herself. Her fault that...
The plate she was washing hit the edge of the sink hard, with all the force of Delia's angry scrubbing. It cracked and split into three pieces. Delia clutched a third of the plate, a triangular, pie-shaped fragment, and for a moment just gaped at it stupidly. Then she noticed the blood running from her palm, mixing with the soap suds and the water, a pink trickle of blood dripping on the sink. She let go of the plate and wrapped her hand in a nearby towel, which quickly turned red. Her palm tingled with pain, but she didn't mind. Pain had become a friend these recent weeks. Pain drove the hollowness away. A knock on the door. She trudged over and opened it. Detective Lyons stood on the welcome mat, her expression severe. An unfamiliar woman stood by her. Another detective? Delia had been discouraged when she'd found out that a woman had investigated her daughter's disappearance. Sure, women were great, and they deserved equality and all that, but it was basic evolution, wasn't it? Men were hunters, women were gatherers. She wanted a hunter to find her daughter. And now here was another woman involved. Perfect. Detective Lyons, she said dryly. What a surprise. She could inject meaning to her words like the best of them. What a surprise, in this case, meant she knew that the police didn't take the disappearance of her daughter seriously. Half the questions they'd asked her had been if Maribel had a reason to leave town without telling her, as if Maribel would just disappear. Any news about Maribel? She asked after a second, because she couldn't not ask it. Because even after all these weeks, after all the false hopes and deep disappointments, she still dared to have faith. 2 weeks ago, her cousin had called her to tell her he'd seen Maribel in New York. She worked as a clerk in the nearby supermarket. Delia hadn't even asked her cousin to make sure, to send her a photo. She'd bought plane tickets and was about to fly over, when her cousin had called again, apologizing. He'd been sure it was Maribel, but it had been a trick of the light. She hadn't been able to get a refund on the flight tickets. Frank was probably furious about the ticket's price, but he hadn't said anything. No, Lyons said. Not yet, I'm sorry. Mrs. Howe, this is Zoe Bentley from the FBI. Delia blinked and regarded Bentley. The FBI? The woman didn't look like she was from the FBI. She was short and thin, her cheeks pink. Her neck was so scrawny it could probably break with one twist. Her eyes, though. For a second, Delia found herself staring into the woman's eyes. Then she looked away, her heart pounding. What was the FBI doing here? Was this about Maribel? Mrs. Howe, can we come in and... Are you okay? You're bleeding. For a second, Delia glanced down at her shirt, as if the dull, hollow throb in her chest had finally developed into a bleeding wound. But no, the detective was talking about her hand. I'm fine, she said, taking a step back, gesturing for them to come inside. I cut myself on a broken plate. Let me see that, the Fed said, and before Delia could react, she grabbed her hand, removing the towel. It was a long gash, and Delia stared at it vacantly, then realized it was near the burn marks, and she snatched her hand away. It's nothing. Had the woman seen the marks? You should put some disinfectant on that, Bentley said. Are you here about Maribel? Delia resisted the urge to hide the hand behind her back. Yes, Bentley answered. I wanted to ask you a few questions about her. Lyons shut the door behind her and walked past Delia to the living room. Delia followed her, feeling out of place in her own house. She vindictively decided not to offer them anything to drink. Lyons took the armchair, and Bentley sat on one side of the couch, leaving the other side for Delia. It was the only place left to sit, and Delia took it, made uncomfortable by the close proximity of the Fed. What do you want to know? She asked. Did your daughter go out a lot? She went out sometimes, Delia answered guardedly. She isn't some sort of slut, if that's what you're implying.
I'm not implying anything, Mrs. Howe. She went out with friends? In the evening?
I guess so. She doesn't live here anymore. She has her own home.
Why is that?
Because she's stubborn. I told her endless times to come back. I didn't want her out of the house.
Why did she leave in the first place?
We argued a lot. She said we were. That I was driving her insane. I was just looking out for her. The arguments popped in Delia's mind like they often did lately. She and Maribel couldn't seem to agree on anything. The way Maribel dressed, the people she met, the way she kept staying out late. They often argued about food. She'd tell Maribel to slow down, not to eat too much, to watch her figure. And Maribel would suddenly lose her temper. Or she'd talk nicely about Jackie's daughter and how thin she was, and Maribel would flip out, as if she'd said it to make a point. If Maribel had only listened, if she'd have been less sensitive about everything. On the street, or any men she recently met, Bentley was saying.
I'm sorry.
I asked if Maribel had been mentioning any strangers she saw on the street, or men she recently met.
No, why?
Is there somewhere your daughter frequented?
She went to her job. She worked at the supermarket near her home.
The woman kept asking questions, endless questions, no answers. And throughout the conversation, Bentley seemed as if she were judging her, blaming her. Finally, Delia lost her temper.
What do you want from me? I don't know anything about Maribel. Once she was 18, she just left. No thank you, nothing. When we talked, we always argued. Is that what you want to hear?
Yes, we argued.
She would never listen to anything I said. I'm her mother and she wouldn't listen. I just tried to help her grow up, that's all. If you find her, can you tell her that? Can you please tell her I just wanted to help?
Her voice was strange, and her vision was blurry with tears. She didn't understand why they were there and what they wanted from her. She thought of the gas stove. Her eyes flicked to the kitchen's doorway and back to Bentley. The way this woman looked at her. She knew. Delia didn't know how, but she knew. She clutched her towel-wrapped hand. Thank you, Mrs. Howe, Bentley said, her voice softening. She drew a card and handed it to her. If you think of anything else about your daughter, please call me. They finally left. Delia locked the door behind them. Then she went straight to the kitchen and turned on the gas, the blue flames flickering. She touched her wrist to the fire. Just 2 seconds, maybe less. The sharp agony shot through her body and she groaned, stumbling back, the emptiness and guilt hidden safely away behind a blanket of pain. Chapter 26. Zoe sat on the motel bed, her back propped against the bulky pillow, laptop on her knees. She'd spent the last couple of hours trying to understand Schrodinger's theories, reading some papers, even watching an online lecture. Though she understood the basics, the details quickly became incomprehensible. She became consumed by an irrational rage and hate against all physics and physicists everywhere. Then her stomach grumbled. In all likelihood, her fury was mostly fueled by hunger. She was, like Andrea liked to say, hangry. She could go grab a bite, but the thought of eating oily Chinese takeout as she did the evening before was depressing. She wanted to go out and eat somewhere, and she wanted company. The obvious company was next door, but he was still sulking. If she was honest with herself, it bothered her quite a bit. Tatum was usually easy-mannered and pleasant. Sure, they had their disagreements here and there, and he could be a frustrating man to deal with. But she couldn't recall a single instance in which he was really angry at her. It was time to talk to him. Though she wasn't sure what had made him fly into such a tantrum, she'd make a blanket of apology for the night before. She'd make amends, buy him dinner. The fact that she rarely ever apologized would only make it easier for him to understand she truly was sorry. She got up and rummaged in her bag and retrieved a short-sleeved white t-shirt and a pair of cut-off jeans. She put them on and glanced at herself in the mirror. She undid her hair, letting it drop on her shoulders,